We have Zach Fiesel back with us, and this is our part two, kind of like the extension of the mysticism in Buddhism, but we're going to, and I said it right this time, you're going to get us a little deeper into the whole karma system and belief in Buddhism, what it really is, what the misconceptions are, and how it really works, because I think there's a pretty big misunderstanding in some of the metaphysical community, in the magic community. And they like to run with those rules that they have really no understanding of how it works.
Yes. So karma is something that a lot of people love to bring up without having any actual knowledge about what it is. And a lot of the knowledge that they do have comes from hearsay or just bad resources, bad information. They never actually looked into the texts like the Vedas or the Upanishads or the Puranas. They never looked at the sadhanas and how karma is related to and the practices of Buddhism or any of the Jain texts. So a lot of people have the idea that karma is you get what you give, and that is only so very superficially true. So the Western misconception is that if I do bad on one person, I'm going to get bad in return. If I do good to someone, I'm going to get good in return. And it's not just how you treat people, and it is not just how others treat you. Karma is so much more elaborate than that. The teachings in the East of what karma is essentially cause and effect, but in a way that goes beyond action A results in B. It's not that direct, it's not that simple. It's not linear. I wouldn't even say it's like a spider web. It's more like an oscillating sphere. If you looked at, what are they called? Oh, I can't think of what they're called, but okay. For those of you who are Harry Potter fans, think of the Time Turner. You have the hourglass in the middle, and then you have the little circle around it, but then there are all these rings that rotate around it. I can't remember what that thing is called. A gyroscope? It's like that. And when they're in movement, the rings turn. They keep turning. They aren't just spinning one way. They keep turning in multiple ways. That is how karma works. It is that oscillating, going through, between, within, without, above, beyond, whatever situation is existing that is causing and creating that specific pattern of karma. It most definitely, for the third time now that I'm saying this, is not. You do one thing and it results in the other thing.
Are you sure? I mean, that's what I don't know.
Now, that doesn't mean I'm dismissing actions. Again, it is cause and effect, but it is a very elaborate form of cause and effect.
Big sigh. Like, yes. I'll be coming.
So, the way karma functions in waking life and in our practical lives, since it is so interconnected, when something happens to us, it could be the result, yes, of one of our past actions. It could be the result of a past life action for those who actually do believe in reincarnation and follow one of the Dharmic faiths, whether it's Hinduism, Buddhism, Jainism, or Sikhism. More often than not, your karma, because again, it's interconnectedness, is the situation you're in. It's not just you. We live on land. That land has karma. We have family members that live with us. their karma is connected to us too. We have animals all around us, even in the air. Their karma is connected to us. So just because something happens, let's say something bad happens, it's not necessarily your fault. And that is another thing. You should never look at someone and judge them and, I guess, wonder what their past karma was. You shouldn't look at someone and be like, oh, I wonder what they did in a past life to deserve that. That's not very... All of the Dharmic faiths kind of tell you to not do that. There are certain people who can see karma and help you navigate a certain situation in your life or what's going to make it easier for you. In Buddhism, we call those karma masters. Specifically in my tradition, the two that I can think of at least are Thai Situ Rinpoche and the Karmapa. If you were to approach any of them, they could tell you pretty quickly what you should do next because they're aware of your karma. But let's take, for instance, you're driving on a road and your tire goes out. You're sharing that road with the spirits of that region, with the land, with other people passing by. It's not just you. You're sharing the karmic consequences of those who built that car, of those who may have ethically or unethically gathered the rubber to supply the making of that tire. It's not always just you and your actions. It is not always just going to be that egotistical thought. You know, it's very much other things as well. And it is very much outer obstacles as well. I talked a little bit about that in the last episode. In the Vajrayana, there's a lot of talk of outer, inner, and secret teachings, outer, inner, and secret offerings, outer, inner, and secret obstacles. Outer obstacles are very real. And when you're in the spiritual community, again, I'll say this again, a lot of people have the tendency to focus on what do I need to fix within myself to solve the problem? Yes, there are things that are within you that you need to work on to fix that problem, but that does not negate or invalidate outer issues. They exist just as much. And another, for those who enter Buddhism, another example of karma is when you get your name. So when you take the first set of vows, the refuge vow, the refuge ceremony in Tibetan Buddhism, you're given a little pamphlet or a card, and it will have usually the refuge prayer. I think I've seen some that contain like a miniature version of the Heart Sutra. It'll have the four sayings of the Buddha, which I talked about last time. Do no harm, practice virtue, tame your mind. These are the sayings of the Buddha. And at the very end, there will be a name. Most of the time, if not all of the time, it's already predetermined. The name on that packet is randomly given. And when you receive it, they say that karma has a way of giving you the correct name for what your journey on, or what your journey into Buddhism is going to be. Personally, I can say that is very true. When I was given mine, so in our tradition, all of our names start with karma, actually. And it's kind of like a family name because of the Karmapa. So my name is Karma Zopa Lundrup, and it means spontaneously accomplished patience. Patience definitely has been a big part of my learning Buddhism because my center is 2.5 hours away from me. And to receive the Lung and the empowerments, I haven't even received any empowerments yet. But to receive the teachings and to receive all of that, for me is going to take time because I am so far away from my Sangha and I am so far away from my Lama. And these things can't be done over the phone. So my name very much has been appropriate into what my experience of Buddhism has been. And I'm sure there are other people who can say the same.
Well, and just the name Patience. I mean, you and I joke around a lot, and I would have to joke, like, you're not always the most patient person.
I most definitely am not. And I tell people, I say this to people often. I go, I was a Sagittarius before I was a Buddhist. I don't know how to not jump into a question without being incredibly opinionated. Now, do I think that has a problem with like conversation? No, I can definitely hear another person's side of the conversation and like understand where they're coming from. But I have a very fiery nature and I get into arguments quickly. but yeah.
I think karma picked right.
Yes.
For this writing for you.
Now, a lot of people also have this idea that karma has to be played out and it has to, there's no way to resolve it. Once you do something, it's going to happen. In the Theravada tradition, which is sometimes called the Hinayana, that is true. Whatever karma you have accumulated has to run its course. In the Mahayana and the Vajrayana, there are ways to either lessen or mitigate or sometimes remove entirely karmic fruition. And it, depending on the practice, certain types of karma are mitigated, while others are kind of just left to be those that just have to come to fruition. So for instance, in Vajrayana, in Tibetan Vajrayana Buddhism, in order for us to practice the higher tantric teachings, specifically of Dzogchen and Mahamudra, we have to undergo what is called Nundro, which are the preliminary practices. Literally translated, Nundro means that which goes before. These typically consist of prostrations and refuge, reciting refuge, the recitation of the Vajrasattva mantra, the accumulation of mandalas, and guru yoga. Most traditions, you have to do 100,000 of these. In my personal tradition, we have to do 111,111 recitations of each four of these things. So we have to do refuge and prostrations 111,111 times. Same with mandalas, same with the Vajrasattva mantra, same with guru yoga. It is only after we've accumulated all of that that our karma is purified enough that we can start learning Dzogchen and Mahamudra.
Now, did they assign those numbers because of like the some sort of sacred numerology, the ones, or do you know? Did they tell you?
That is part of it. The accumulation of vast amounts of mantra, specifically mantra recitation, is something that is kind of only seen in the Vajrayana, and in my experience, only seen in Tibetan Vajrayana practices. I'm not so sure about, you know, Shingon in Japan or the Chan religion or the Chan sect in China. But in esoteric and mystical Buddhism, I really only see that kind of practice done in Tibetan Vajrayana. But part of it is sacred numerology. And the other is honestly, I think psychologically, you know, when you do something that many times, it re-patterns your thinking process to be more compassionate so you don't accumulate karma, to have more wisdom so you don't fall into the traps of the ideology of karma, you know. But I think it also developed into that because my teacher once told me the story of Milarepa and how that was kind of like the precursor to why we have Nundro. But historically, this could even probably go back to India. I haven't really read any articles that it does or doesn't. I haven't really looked into it, so I can't really talk with an informed opinion about that. But with the story of Milarepa, he had this life where his parents were wronged, and he made this promise that he would avenge them by practicing dark magic and getting back at those who wronged his family. And eventually he saw that this caused more problems than it solved. So he found Marpa, his teacher. And Marpa kept saying, "No, I won't teach you. No, you won't be my disciple." Until eventually he said, "I want you to build a tower. And basically, go build this tower, then we'll talk." So he built a tower. He came back to Marpa and he said, "Now go tear it down." He tore it down. He came back to Marpa. He said, "Go build another tower." So he did. He came back. He said, "Go tear that one down." So he did. Came back again. He's built and tore down by hand, brick by brick, two towers so far. Then Marpa said, "Go build another tower." So he built it. And that third tower, till today, still stands. And when Milarepa returned to Marpa and asked, "Why did you make me do all of that?" He said, "Because of your past karma, it needed to be purified, or you would not understand anything that I'm about to teach you." He also wanted Milarepa to show that he was truly devoted, not just to Marpa, but to the teachings of the Dharma. So psychologically, when you t undertake this massive accumulation of 111,111 practices or recitations four times, it again repatterns your brain to you're taking this seriously. And so you receive it a little more easier because it is the fruit of all of this labor. You're finally getting what you worked so hard for. So like I said, it repatterns the thought process, and it's a little easier, I think, to understand things that are taught to you after you finally worked so hard and you get the reward. You can now just sit and rest and accept what's being taught to you.
Well, I know that you've said karma isn't this whole, you're either going to suffer this life because you had too good of a life last time, or the other way around. But I mean, what exactly is karma, and why in some traditions are you trying to get to a zero point, like neither too good or too bad?
So, karma literally translated means action. And I think that is probably the best explanation of what karma is. It's not just cause and effect. Cause and effect create an action, but it is not, karma is not the result. Karma just is action. Nothing created it, nothing comes after it. And that's where, when you start getting into the wisdom teachings and the teachings of the paramitas, especially the Prajnaparamita, it's kind of like, without going too far into this, because I definitely am not certified to do so or authorized to do so, karma doesn't really exist. Just like we don't really exist. The idea in the Heart Sutra is that things can be taken apart infinitely. You will never have something that exists in and of by its own self. Same goes for karma. Where we get into the problem is when we don't realize that things are relative, conditions are relative. So, although ultimately, they are not real, or at least lack inherent existence. They will still affect you because of the conditions that are surrounding you. If we were to go back to that zero point, we wouldn't have surrounding conditions, so we wouldn't have karmic problems. But because so many things over the years since creation have built up, we have conditions, and those conditions very much affect us. They are very much real to us. Now, for those who practice Jainism, they're always striving to get to the zero point. They don't want to have good karma. They don't want to have bad karma. They want to get to utter awareness of nothingness, or emptiness, I should say. For Buddhists, that's kind of a goal, especially more in the Theravada tradition. In the Mahayana, we want to experience emptiness and the nature of our mind and wisdom, but then come back and help others get there too. So again, karma doesn't really exist ultimately, but because of our situations in the world we live in and the things that have happened up to this point, it is very real to us. It very much affects us. It very much is here.
Now, how, I believe there's like karma, and if you know, in some of the Hindu traditions, is it similar? Is it treated kind of the same way?
Yes. So in Hinduism, karma, I think this is kind of where people get the idea that karma is linear. And this is also kind of where a lot of people don't, they look at Hinduism, they look at the Eastern religions, and they're like, oh, it's all love and light and it's all pretty. Hinduism is very much oppressive historically because of the idea of karma and how it reinforced the caste system. Now, I say oppressive, and I'm looking at it through the lens of my millennial, very socially aware, ethnocentric eye. You know, what is normal culture to one tradition is oppression to another. But karma, Hinduism, etc., those ideas caused problems. It supported the caste system. The idea of karma in Hinduism is, if you live your dharma, dharma in the Hindu context, meaning if you live your position in the caste system out well, and you do it well enough, you have the opportunity to go up the caste system in your next life. And so it was very much by religion kind of forced into people that unless you want to have a horrible life next time, you better do what you're told to do. Which sounds a little familiar in the West, doesn't it?
Yeah, I'm sure some of us who are recovering and reforming can be like, yeah, I remember those days.
And again, this is a problem because of the fetishization of Eastern cultures. People don't like to go deep diving and to find out that, oh my God, this sounds so much like Catholicism. They're like, that's where love and light came from. That's where all these happy ideas came from. They're not so happy.
Oh, right. Well, and I think that's one reason why I'm so glad we're having this conversation, because there's so much, just the skim work, the top work of information that people know, and they don't always know that there could be more, right? Because maybe who they look up to, who's kind of giving them brief teachings, didn't pass on more information, you know, not knowing that there's more to know. And quite honestly, I mean, other than talking with you, I've never really had a big interest in diving into Buddhism. I think it's neat. I think it's cool. And if that's what you choose to do, more power to you. But, you know, when you and I had the sidebar conversation after we ended the live, you know, and I'm like, oh, well, we need to go more into that because there's so much more to unpack. You know, and like how we briefly touched on, again, before we went live this time, that hole in the Wiccan reed about do no harm or it's going to come back to you times three, and how it kind of sounds like karma, but not really.
Yeah.
You know, and then you brought up a good point. That's only if you believe in it.
Yeah. With the note of like the law of three and that, okay. Karma, as it traditionally is taught, will not come back to you harsher than whatever action you took to create it. It's not going to come back to you threefold, tenfold, whatever. It comes back to you equally. What is it in your tradition? What is that called? In Peruvian shamanism. Equal return. What is that called?
Oh, no, the Aini, the reciprocity. Aini,
yes, reciprocity. It is very much like that.
It's kind of similar yet different, because to be an Aini is to give and take equally.
Yeah.
Maybe not so much in... like, oh my God, I cut that person off. Now I have that karma for the day.
Right.
But it's more of like, you know, be willing to help others, but at the same time, being willing to accept the help for yourself, because you can create your own heaviness and fall out of that irony.
Yeah.
If you're always the giver and you never receive.
Mm-hmm.
So similar, kind of yet different. I don't know if I can communicate effectively, like how I see that difference being.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's not a whole lot. I don't know. I'm gonna have to talk with my shaman. Like, how do you want to compare these two? Do they compare?
Yeah, that'd be interesting.
Yeah, I need to get Zane on a podcast.
But also with the idea of like, it's funny because recently I've seen some people kind of backpedal a little bit on the, threefold law and say it's not literal, it's meant to be taken symbolically, like make sure you really want to do something to someone before you actually do it. And they're just kind of like compounding the idea of make sure they deserve it. And I'm like, I don't think that was the context it was written in, but if you want to reinterpret it, by all means go ahead. But karma, like I said, will not come back to you stronger or weaker than whatever caused it to begin with. It comes back. I don't want to say that there's this worldview in Buddhism that the earth or the universe tries to keep an equilibrium with itself, because that's not what we're taught. We are taught that there was creation and that there are many worlds beyond the world we know.
Mm-hmm.
And some of those worlds we're trying to get to. It's like the Pure Lands, Sukhavati, Aburati. Personally, I would love... So most Pure Land sects and most Tibetan Buddhist lineages often want to go to Sukhavati, which is the Pure Land of Amitabha. I personally would rather go to the Pure Land of Akshobhya, which is Aburati, because Akshobhya deals with anger, and that is definitely that fiery nature that I have. That is definitely something that I want to come to bring under control a little more. Or Vaiduya Prabhurajaya, which is the Pure Land of Medicine Buddha, which eventually will become my main practice when I receive the empowerment. But we're not trying to keep the universe in equilibrium. We are trying to make amends for any harm we have done and create better conditions in the future for ourselves to meet the Dharma, to come to enlightenment, to bring others to enlightenment in whatever way that may be, but that is an entirely other conversation. You can find Dharma in any religion, but to better it for ourselves and to better it for others. Those are the karmic aims that we strive for.
Now, when you say to make amends for any karma that you may have done, I mean, I'm assuming you don't want to become so obsessed with constantly feeling the need that you have to make amends for everything, right?
Right.
I mean, that would just be a whole unhealthy way
I could get toxic real quick.
Right. You know, to worry about, like, oh my God, I just did this. Now I have to go do this. And, you know, are there prescribed methods of, like, you know, if you did this, then the equalizer is this, you know, are there, do they tell you like what that might be?
Yep. So a lot of religions kind of boil down to ethics, right? And making you aware of your actions, not just from the past, but what you're doing now. And for those who do practice the path sincerely, it makes us rethink our actions. It makes us, now obviously none of us are perfect and we're going to mess up, or we're even going to acknowledge that we're messing up and continue to do it. For instance, setting a trap to kill an animal, like a mouse. The mouse is pooping everywhere and it's eating all of the flour and the rice. You know, it's doing what mice do. That just is its nature. And you want to kill it so you don't have to deal with it. There are certain, how should I say, levels of, I guess, how bad it's going to turn out for you as the one killing the mouse. This is explained a little more in depth if you take the five precepts. There has to be intention, there has to be action, there has to be a follow through, there has to be no remorse. Like, there's a lot of things that are involved in it and breaking the five precepts. But let's say there's a termite infestation. I need to get an exterminator in. You're part of the process of killing that animal. It's going to have a karmic imprint on you. Now, like I said, there are ways to either dampen and lessen that karmic return or even eliminate it. Those methods typically deal with the recitation of mantra. And specifically for anyone can do this. Let's say you see a hawk killing a mouse, or a bird killing a worm, eating a worm. So long as they're within earshot, even though, you know, we can't really tell how animals, you know, how earthworms hear, you know, it's more vibration or whatever. If they can hear you chant Om Mani Padme Hum, it increases their karmic ability to come back as something better, and it gives you merit. For those who do actions that hurt another, there's the Vajrasattva mantra. There's the long version, there's the short version. I believe it was during 9/11, one Rinpoche asked that everyone recite the short version, which is Om Benzo Sato Hung. And for the long version, and really for the short version, you should have the Lung first. I don't believe Vajrasattva is one of those deities that, and just anyone can practice. There are certain mantras that are available to anyone, no matter what, such as the Chen Rizig mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum, Tara's mantra, Medicine Buddha's mantra. Vajrasattva is more of a mystical Buddhist deity, so you should have the proper instructions for that. But when I do confession, we recite the seven branch prayer. And that is a way to amend any bad karma that I've created throughout the day. And you're supposed to bring to mind those things you specifically know were not you behaving correctly. But it also covers all of those other things you did throughout the day that you never give a second thought to. You know, Jains usually sweep the ground in front of them when they walk to move bugs out of the way. We don't do that. So we're stepping on ants all the time and smaller insects, and that causes a karmic problem. But for the everyday person, having just simply remorse or doing something but doing it with regret and being aware of the fact that it's causing harm, I think has some kind of karmic band-aid for that situation.
I had to unmute because I'm sitting and I'm listening and I'm thinking and I'm like, huh. Now the skeptic in me is like, Earth just seems like it's a whole big trap to trap you in karma. Because unless from the day that you're born and you don't breathe, you don't move, you don't do anything, you're going to cause, karma, probably more negative if you want to get onto the side of the Jains, right? Because if you can't hurt anything, and that's where I, sometimes I'm like, the universe is a sarcastic bitch, right?
Yeah.
She sets us up so hard. So I mean, I can see, and I have great respect for people who are that aware of everything that they do and how it can ripple and how it can affect. I myself would not have that discipline. I try to be aware of others and be conscious of that and not to cause problem, but and I am not going to sweep the ground in front of my feet.
Yeah.
I'm not going to purposefully. Well, you know what? I take that back. Gardening a couple years ago and came across an ant pile and they bit me. So you know what? I smacked them because they're biting me. I feel no sorrow over this.
Yeah. And when, and that's a good thing that you, that shows that you're thinking critically, because every student is going to get to that point. And the, I guess the response that I can give without being a llama is kind of twofold. The first is that is where we start uncovering the Prajnaparamita teachings and the ideas of emptiness and how karma really isn't real. And that's part of enlightenment, is when you get to the point where you're beyond the confines of karma. You're beyond the confines of the conditions of this realm. You're beyond the confines of what is quote unquote our reality. But until you reach enlightenment, you're going to be affected by karma. The second part of that is there are some practices and there are some traditions where you can accumulate merit that surpasses any negative karma that has yet to be come to fruition or be ripened.
How do you get merits?
So you can have merit. So, like I said, let's say you saw that animal, that worm being eaten by a bird. By chanting Om Mani Padme Hum, not only does that add a little bit of merit to that worm's bucket, it adds a little to yours as well. That worm got to hear a mantra from the Dharma, so it improves their chances of being reborn in a higher life form. Might still be in the animal realm, but at least it won't be a worm. By you having compassion enough to recite that mantra to benefit that being, that sentient being, you now have a little bit more merit. And that merit, especially if you then share it or dedicate it, after every practice, we dedicate the merit to the enlightenment of all sentient beings, not one left behind. That multiplies the merit that you gained. And that kind of is what Nundro is part of too. You're not just doing 111,111 recitations or practices. You're also dedicating merit, so it multiplies it by many times over. And then if you were to do that, let's say on an astrological date that is very sacred in Tibetan astrology, it multiplies it even more. So like full moons, eclipses, Dakini days, Guru Rinpoche days. There are much more higher practices and tantras that if you practice, like I said, if you looked at it like a level, let's say if your karma is at 50% level and your merits are at 75, you've surpassed your karmic debt. You now, at that point, you're probably enlightened. But now you can return or choose not to return. Once you get to the point of surpassing karma, and once you reach enlightenment, you choose whether you come back or not. you're in control of returning here or staying in nirvana. And those who do choose to reincarnate, if they were teachers or lamas, we call them tulkus. The Karmapa, the head of our lineage, was the first reincarnated teacher in, or I should say, first reincarnated lineage of teachers in Tibet. The Dalai Lama is the more well-known one, but he came after. The Karmapa chooses when to come back. The Dalai Lama chooses when to come back. They're enlightened enough that karma does not affect them.
So a little side note, speaking of reincarnation, and this is a favorite devil's advocate theory thrown out there, that if it's reincarnation and somebody dies and they come back, how does the population keep growing faster than what humans started out as?
There is this idea, I can't think of the specific lineage holders, but I believe they're Nyingma, where typically when they come back, they never come back as one person. They always come back as two, and they hold the lineage together. I don't believe it was Ponlop Rinpoche. It's either Nyingma or Kagyu. They're the same being. They just reincarnate into two different bodies. So this idea of simultaneous reincarnation could come from that, especially if you were someone who practiced Tantra, or really, in my opinion, any mystical teaching where you still have to make amends for something. The quickest way to do that would be to come back at the same time in multiple bodies. Many hands make light work. So I think it could be something like that.
Interesting. I was thinking you were gonna, you know, say, well, that's because there's a bunch of teachers that keep coming back. And then my rebuttal was gonna be, then why is it so messed up now? There's so many teachers walking around.
The other thing is, okay, so the Buddha that we talk about when we say the Buddha, the awakened one, Shakyamuni, Siddhartha Gautama, he is the Buddha of our age. Now, there have been Buddhas since Padmasambhava, or Guru Rinpoche is one of the better known ones. He, Siddhartha Gautama, Shakyamuni Buddha, he is the Buddha of our age, meaning he is the one whose teachings we, this I'll say generation, but I don't just mean 20 years. I mean from his beginning of his teaching until the next Buddha arises. Those are the teachings that we follow. He oftentimes talked about how we live in the degenerate age. So once he entered parinirvana, once he died, everything would be in decline from that moment onward until the next Buddha arose, who is Maitreya. So what once used to be these traditions of great teachers who never had conflict or temptation or contradicted themselves or the teaching steadily declined. And the more famous ones who are known are Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche. He was very scandalous. You have even recently the Tulku lineage of Bardor Rinpoche. He passed recently. And I believe back in 2010, there were some scandals with that and they wouldn't let him teach. And so like there have been these great teachers who have been flawed since the time of Buddha, and it's only going to continue to get worse until, you know, the coming of the next Buddha, Maitreya. And so the Tulku lineages, they're the teachers. The rest of us lay folk, when we reincarnate, if we get the chance to come back as human and we didn't go backward, I think that is more of like the simultaneous reincarnation.
What a downer, Zach. I need another drink after all that. Like it's only going to get worse. Thanks, buddy.
Yeah. It's only going to get worse. Sadly, a lot of our teachers, and that's another thing. It's really difficult to navigate Tibetan Buddhism, especially because there's such this emphasis on devotion to the teacher. And when the teacher is flawed, and we see things like, you know, Mipham Rinpoche and that whole scandal.
What was the scandal for those of us that don't know?
It was either Mipham or Mikyong. I don't remember that. Well, there was Mikyong Rinpoche, but he just decided to leave and be a nomad for a minute. There was a sex scandal. There was very much like Trungpa Chogyam Rinpoche. There was a sex scandal. There was sexual misconduct. There was...
Oh, so your standard religious leader.
Yes. You know. It's okay. And, you know, a lot of people, again, look at the Eastern religions as like perfect. They're not. Mm-hmm. These are humans practicing. Even if they are reincarnated, even if they have great karma, they're still bound by the conditions that surround us. It is only when they are pure spirit matter and realize the nature of their mind and they're in that kind of realm that they are perfect. When they come back here, they still have to deal with temptations. But yeah, just like the Catholic Church has its scandals, so too does Tibetan Buddhism. And like I said, it was prophesied, it will only continue to get worse. And like I said, there's this problem of the devotion to the guru, and when they start messing up, then that becomes murky, and it's, you know, a lot of teachers have kind of come out to explain, take the teachings. Those teachings don't only belong to the teacher. They belong to you. They belong to the rest of the Sangha that received them. Those teachings are perfect and pristine.
Mm-hmm.
The conveyor of those teachings might not be. Take the Dharma, leave the rest.
You know, it makes me think of a certain angel lady who we won't say the name, just let's avoid lawsuits, who has renounced so many things that she used to do and teach. Yeah. And, you know, I would get a lot of customers coming in and they're like, but I love these card decks. I love, you know, working with them. And now they're supposed to be bad. And I'm like, no. If they've worked for you and they still continue to work for you, and it's always been something that's been a healing thing for you, then accept the cards and forget that she's attached to them.
Yeah.
You know, we don't know what's going on in that world that she's in now. But that's not where you're at. So, you know, trying to understand that the knowledge and the benefit that you were given, you know, can still exist just because the person who taught it to you, you know, suddenly is having issue and maybe stepping away in some way, shape, or form.
Right.
I mean, it's almost like where the student surpasses the teacher in a way.
Yeah.
To still hold that teaching and hold it in a higher regard than what the teacher is doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's true teachers who are mindful of what they do and who are perfectly unflawed will never tell you anything that contradicts the Dharma. If we're talking in the Tibetan Buddhist context, there will be situations where you question them, just like Milarepa questioned Marpa. Why are you making me build all these towers? This isn't doing anything. There's a method behind the madness. Mm-hmm. Now, sexual misconduct exists in the Vinaya. The Vinaya is where the five precepts come from. That was one of the very first traditions for the history of Buddhism. If they're contradicting foundational teachings, your teacher is not as enlightened as you may want them to be or think they are. So there is a warning here of whatever your teacher may be, New Age, Hindu, even Jewish Kabbalah, and who the rabbi you speak to and teaches you. Make sure you spend time with them. Actually, during my Nyingye retreat, the Lama who was teaching goes, you're new to Buddhism. before you, he said, before you pick a teacher, it used to be said, spend at least 5 years with them. He goes, my advice now is to spend at least 10 years with them before you claim them as your teacher. They, the teacher, will often examine the disciple or the potential disciple. The disciple should also be very scrutinizing of the teacher. That's not to say that your opinion of the Dharma should be seen as higher than their opinion of the Dharma. If they're teaching the Dharma, you would be able to recognize it is truth.
Now back slightly, it's going to tie in between reincarnation and karma. And you had said those that are enlightened, they can choose to come back and help the rest of us poor souls mucking about, right?
Yep.
Get there. Has an enlightened being ever come down in this tradition and got so confined and tripped up that they kind of lost some of their karma points? Weren't considered as enlightened.
Historically, not that I know of. In contemporary time, you could say that. Like I said, the most recent Jamgon control in that reincarnation Tulku lineage left Buddhism to become a doctor. He's studying to be a doctor. He actually was close friends with the Karmapa. And the Karmapa has made a statement about that. And then, like I said earlier, Mikyong Rinpoche, who is probably one of the more better-known Kagyu teachers. He has a lot of videos on YouTube talking about the recitation of the mantra Oma Hung, a little bit about dream yoga. He talks extensively about many concepts in Tantric Buddhism. He left out of nowhere one day. He wrote a letter and said that he was leaving the monastery. He took up the robes of a yogi, which a lot of Nyingma practitioners, the Nakbas, they wear this, but there are some Repas who wear the white robe. The white and red is more of like what is broadly considered the robe of the yogi. Meaning he, and I don't exactly know how this works with giving back vows, he essentially decided to live amongst commoners and be a nomad. And he did eventually come back. And you could say in those instances, they were lacking in karma, or they were lacking in their awakened nature. But you could also see it as, since they're both now taking on, you know, they were these once revered, or, you know, still to a point are, these revered enlightened beings are kind of modernizing. You have Jamgon Kongtro Rinpoche, very enlightened being, very strong lineage, is now a doctor. That's still very beneficial to people. That is still Dharma, helping people. You have Mikyong Rinpoche, who had monastic vows, is now practicing as a householder practitioner. Not that he has a family or anything, but teaching and practicing in the way of a Nakba.
Now, before these two, like when you say left and like went to become a doctor, went to be a nomad, were they sitting in a temple?
Yes.
See, and that's interesting because in this, my tradition, I won't say they frown upon just sitting up high on the mountain and go, look at me. I'm so spiritual. I'm so better. I'm so in touch. Because it's, well, what are you doing in your Aini to help those around you and to help? You know, you're wasting away and you know, you're not doing anything. So, you know, kind of in our tradition, you can be enlightened, but you are to help others. So, you know, me, I'm cheering on the doctor. Like, hey, you know, you're providing services to somebody who may not be able to get it.
Yeah. And you that's know? Kind of like the point that I was trying to make is they went from being enlightened But now taking that enlightenment and integrating it into in a helpful way, or I guess more effectively beneficial way on the physical realm to people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're not just teaching. They're actively helping. Not to say that teachers don't actively help, because we have a lot of mental and emotional obstacles, and teachers, I do think, do that. Monastic teachers, nakpas, repas. But even then, like with the repa tradition, which is the like the yogic tradition of the Kamsankaju, the Karmakaju, Justin von Boydash, he works at a correctional facility in Rikers. He works at that prison. I can't think of what it's called right now, on Rikers Island. But that is an idea, or that is an example of, in my opinion, who is an enlightened being, actively working compassion.
Mm-hmm. Right. You know, and I would like to say that, you know, maybe the gentleman who left to be nomadic, like, how else to get a better firsthand experience of what the rest of us are going through, of what those challenges are, you know, to sit up in a temple somewhere and preach about what should or shouldn't be done or how you should or shouldn't act. But, you know, like, get down here with the rest of us and see what's going on and why it's so hard. So, you know, I cheer on those misfits that left for a minute, you know?
Yeah. All right. And the last thing I want to talk about, which I think is very important, karma only affects those who practice one of the Dharmic faiths. Karma should be taken in the context it came from. Karma affects Hindus. Karma affects Buddhists. Karma affects Jains. And to some extent, karma affects Sikhs. Karma does not affect Christians. Karma, in a different concept, or I guess I should say a different language, kind of affects Jews. They have their own ideas of what I guess you could equate to as karma. Karma does not affect Muslims. It does not affect root workers. It does not affect witches. It does not affect brujos. It does not affect santeros. It does not affect sansistas. It does not affect anyone outside of a Dharmic faith. If you are someone who has issues with hexing someone, good. You should. You should be thinking, does this person deserve it? Is it justifiable? That does not mean that if you decide it is justifiable, and if you throw that hex or curse, that something bad is going to happen to you. Mm-hmm. Karma does not affect those outside of Dharmic faiths. Don't say to someone who could use magic in a darker way to benefit themselves in a dire situation that they shouldn't do it simply because you believe that you're looking out for their best interest. With that said, karma also only affects those who believe in it, even if they are outside of one of those four Dharmic faiths. If you believe karma is going to affect you, karma is going to affect you. One of the most famous quotes in the Dhammapada, the sayings of the Buddha, is our minds and our thoughts create our reality.
I was getting ready to say it affects you because you believe it's going to.
Yes.
Not because that religion or faith supersedes, you know, some sort of pagan worship, some sort of Christian worship.
Yes.
It's just because in your mind you think you're going to get it. Which is, you know, sometimes funny to read these little chat boards online and of the whole whether or not you should or shouldn't cast, you know, like I can get the whole non-hexing, but then there are people that believe you're not even supposed to do spells for prosperity. Yeah. Because it's selfish and it's taking from somebody else. And I'm like, wow, we have nothing else better to argue about. There's enough abundance for everybody. It's just how are you going about asking for it?
Yeah.
you know, you shouldn't gain abundance by purposely taking it from somebody. But if you're asking the universe to create abundance for you and you allow the possibility to happen, the universe is not going to go take it from somebody else to give it to you.
Oh yeah. Especially, so. Okay. So with abundance itself, there are practices that we do that help us receive, you know, money and wealth. And you would think, oh, money, wealth, those are so bad. Why do they exist in Buddhism? Because that makes it easier to go to teachings if you have the money to go to teachings. That makes it easier if you're not starving and looking for basic needs.
Mm-hmm.
And in the Mahayana tradition, and I forget what sutra it was, Zambala makes an appearance, and Buddha said, or Zambala protects Buddha as Buddha's giving a sermon, and there were rocks thrown at Zambala. It injured Zambala. Buddha came over, blessed him, and it healed his wounds. And the way Buddha did so is he put his hand over his head and light came out like a waterfall. And he said, from this point on, anyone who pours water over your head, you are to help with their money, with their finances. As you protected me, protect those who seek your help. So I have the Zambala offering set, and although I don't have the transmission, and although I don't have, I guess, the permissions to do it, because it exists in the Mahayana tradition, I can do it. And there's a lot of, again, devotion is very important in Tibetan Buddhism. I didn't have any of those permissions, and I still poured water over this, over a statue of Zambala, and with devotion asked for his help, and I received it. So even in dharmic faith, you're allowed to do certain things that some people would say are shady, I guess. Like you were saying, people think that prosperity, you know, takes from another person. No, it is freely there. You just have to ask for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it's been an interesting conversation. We went over an hour again.
Yeah.
Hopefully everybody else will be as entertained as we were.
Hopefully.
But Zach, you, if anybody wanted to get in touch with you for any of your services, because you also do, you know, some root working. Mm-hmm. And we kind of went over that in the first episode of this about how you are able to kind of marry the two together. So it's not, it is a contradiction, but it's not a contradiction. Mm-hmm. So how would somebody get a hold of you for guidance or workings?
On Facebook would probably be the easiest way. If you go into your search bar on Facebook and type in Red Cloth White Candle Brujeria, you can contact me through there.
And you are available through Goddess Elliot at times.
I am.
When we're able to snag you around your work schedule.
Yes.
So you can always keep an eye on goddesselite.com. And if you'd like and rather prefer to come see Zach in person, he's a fun guy. We stand around and we joke a lot when we're not busy. So come hang out with us. And sometimes your mom comes too, and she's yes. Hilarious. I love your mom.
Everyone loves my mother.
But thanks for enlightening us and clearing up the karmic understandings and beliefs and how it should be addressed, instead of, you know, this misconception of, you know, like you said, if somebody's having it way too easy by our opinion this lifetime, that must mean they had a hellacious one last time, and that's the only reason why they can have it so good.
Yeah.
What judgy people we are, aren't we?
Yes.
Stop being so judgmental, people. All right. Well, thanks for joining us for our karmic version, or not version, but episode of Mysticism in Buddhism with Zach Fiesel. And look him up on Facebook. Keep an eye on the website. We will have him back hopefully here soon.
And, yes.
All right, everybody. Have a good night. Bye-bye.